Today, we're pleased to welcome Praveen Fernandez to Law and Disorder. He serves as vice president at the Constitutional Accountability Center in Washington, D.C. The center is a public interest law firm and think tank committed to realizing the progressive ideals embedded in the Constitution's text and history. Praveen brings to the table nearly two decades of experience working on issues related to law, democracy, and civil rights, both within and outside the government. Praveen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's so great to be with you.
Praveen, what was your reaction to last week's news that the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump is disqualified from holding office?
You know, I think the decision was so meticulous. It was driven by facts and the law. And I think it represents a huge win for Colorado voters, for democracy, and constitutional accountability in general. It affirmed the district court's carefully drawn factual findings that January 6th was an insurrection and that Donald Trump engaged in it. And it reversed the district court in some other ways by finding that the disqualification clause applies to presidents and to the presidency, as we had urged the court to do in the Constitutional Accountability Center's amicus brief. So I think what I think was powerful was the Colorado Supreme Court held, because Donald Trump engaged in insurrection, he's constitutionally disqualified from serving as president and therefore should not be listed on the presidential primary ballot in Colorado.
Now, before we dig in a bit to the decision and the repercussions, you're vice president of the Constitutional Accountability Center. So obviously this case really goes to the heart of your mission. Can you briefly tell us what other issues your work involves at the center?
Sure, Heidi. We're a progressive public interest law firm and think tank, and we don't have a specific issue area focus, which has allowed us to be involved in almost every issue that progressives care about. Think about reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus equality, immigrant rights, protecting the environment, et cetera. We don't have an issue focus, but we do have a methodology. And I guess for lack of a better description, some have described it as progressive originalism. And what we believe is that we think that conservatives have told, you know, a false account of what the text and history of the Constitution actually dictates. And what the text and history of the Constitution actually supports, we believe, is progressive outcomes, outcomes that make our nation freer and fairer and more inclusive. And so we are dedicated to ensuring that text and history arguments are presented before the court.
Yes, I've got to say that when I was reading about the organization online, I was really interested to see the reference to the Constitution's text, because for so many of us, when we hear textualism or originalism, we think of Scalia and more conservative analyses. I have to ask, is your organization at all related to the Constitution Center?
That's another great group. But no, we have no formal arrangement with the Constitution Center. The Constitutional Accountability Center is just a standalone organization. But I thought your comment was so good. I would say that, you know, years ago, I probably would have had the same visceral reaction. And I think that's partially just because conservatives have told a distorted story about the Constitution. And I think that's either because they fetishized the base document from the 1700s and paid short shrift to the amendments, which, of course, in stepwise fashion made our nation, you know, incrementally freer and fairer and more inclusive. But sometimes also, the progressive history has been discarded when it didn't suit conservative either jurists or litigants. And so, for instance, let me just give one example, which might make it seem a little bit less abstract, because if I'm saying it might not make sense. You know, we're the sort of group that likes to present these text and history arguments. So if you think about like this last term at the Supreme Court, as the justices were considering affirmative action and were faced with arguments by conservatives that, you know, the equal protection language in the 14th Amendment somehow mandated race blindness and would render affirmative action unconstitutional. So we were a group that dove into the historical record, the enactment history around the 14th Amendment. And what we found, which will, of course, be of no surprise to Reconstruction era scholars, is that we found that the same Congress, the 39th Congress, that shaped and proposed the 14th Amendment, also passed landmark pieces of legislation, such as the Freedmen's Bureau Act, which was explicitly race conscious and which provided race conscious remedies to address the undeniable history of discrimination against Black Americans. So, in other words, we don't think that the historical record in any way makes problematic affirmative action. In fact, we think that the historical record made it clear that the framers of the 14th Amendment didn't find that the 14th Amendment's provisions were incompatible with race-conscious remedies. And arguably, as one of my colleagues, David Gams, often says, the framers of the 14th Amendment could be considered the originators of affirmative action. And so that's the sort of historical record that we try to bring in our amicus briefs. And it tries to combat, I think, a story that conservatives often tell that distorts the enactment history of constitutional provisions.
Oh, thank you. And yes, I noticed that your organization has filed a few hundred amicus briefs, something that I think is really important to sort of help the public understand issues that are being litigated in these so-called friend of the court briefs. Speaking of the 14th Amendment, Praveen, can you describe briefly when was Section 3, the disqualification clause, written and why was it written?
Oh, it's a great question. So I've already referenced the Reconstruction Amendments a little bit. So Section 3 is part of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. And the 14th Amendment, along with the 13th and 15th Amendments, is considered a Reconstruction Amendment. That means an amendment that was added in the period of our history after the Civil War, a period so significant that some historians refer to it as the second founding of our nation. And that the historical backdrop is important here. These amendments were added as our nation was coming out of this violent war that nearly tore our union apart. And we were grappling, of course, with the fact that some of the promises in the Declaration of Independence were not only not fully meaningful, but were purely illusory to a large chunk of our nation. And, you know, when you think about the brutal institution of slavery and its subjugation, it proves that a lot of the soaring language of the Declaration of Independence, you know, was illusory for our nation. And sort of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were trying to address that, trying to bring our nation out of the war, trying to do things that stabilized our democracy, made it more fair, more equal, and more inclusive. So, you know, you're thinking of the abolition of chattel slavery, the Equal Protection Amendment, birthright citizenship, expanding the voting rights of individuals. And so the historical backdrop is important for this particular provision, Section 3, because, you know, what we faced in this fragile nation coming out of the Civil War is the fact that there were a lot of people who had taken oaths to support the Constitution. So think of Confederate generals, Confederates, et cetera, who had taken up arms against our nation. And there was a fear that was reflected by the framers of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that if Section 3 was not drafted, you would have individuals who had taken an oath to support the Constitution, who had then violated that oath by taking up arms against our nation, then vying to serve in office again. And they were profoundly worried about the destabilizing effect that would have on the nation that was trying to come out of this conflict. And they considered lots of different versions, some that were specific to Confederate officers, and they decided instead to have this more open-ended language about officers and insurrection, not Confederate officers, but officers. And so that's the backdrop of when this amendment was considered and ratified in the late 1800s.
Oh, thank you for that. Let's bring it back to current day for a moment. What are the other three states where lawsuits have been brought to disqualify Trump from the ballots? And are they all similar, basically, in their demands to the Colorado case?
Right. Minnesota, Michigan, and Oregon are the other three states, where these lawsuits have been brought. And, you know, there are some differences because the primary systems are different in each state. And obviously, there are different groups that are involved with that. The one in Colorado, the lawyers were the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and local council. But yes, the essence of all the lawsuits are the same. It's challenges by voters who are asking that someone who's constitutionally ineligible to hold office not be on their primary ballot.
Praveen, going back to what you mentioned about the addition of this clause, some fear that violence from Trump supporters will result around the country if Trump is disqualified. And that fear seems to defeat the framers' very reason for crafting this clause. There's a certain irony there. How heavily do you think that may weigh on jurists deciding these cases?
I think the fear and threat of violence, is a real one. Obviously, we saw what happened on January 6th, and so it's a very real and sobering possibility. But I think for individuals who care about the possibility of violence, they should care even more deeply about enforcing this clause, which of course was about anti-democratic behavior. It was about insurrection. It was about using force to tamper with the democratic process. It is reflecting a concern about force and violence. And so we should want to enforce that. And so to the extent we're concerned about it, we should want more, not less, enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. I'm heartened by the decision from the Colorado Supreme Court that had lots of language in the opinion about taking their responsibility seriously, casting aside how, the opinion would be received by the body politic, which I think you're asking with your very sensitive question. And, just being driven by the facts and the law and, honoring the oaths they took as justices to be supporting the Constitution and driven by the facts and the law. But, honestly, I don't think anybody can say, how this will play out in terms of the reaction from Trump supporters. And I think you're right to be concerned. And I think it's because those concerns are real that we should want to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Praveen, I read with interest your recent Newsweek piece on this topic. One thing that I had a question about is your reference to the fact that some people feel enforcing the disqualification clause of the 14th Amendment is anti-democratic. And I don't really understand that logic. Could you elaborate a bit?
You and me both, Heidi. I don't understand the logic either. I mean, to the best of my ability, I think to summarize the concerns, I think there's some who feel like the voters should be able to vote on any candidate they want. But it ignores the fact that that's not how we have treated presidential qualifications. So if there were somebody who was not yet 35 or who wasn't a natural born citizen, we don't simply say, well, this is a popular candidate, we should let the voters decide. We obey the plain text of the Constitution, which, of course, is itself a democratically enacted document, not only democratically enacted, but by the stringent supermajorities that have to happen for constitutional text to be part of our Constitution, right? Like, it has to go through supermajorities, it has to go to the states to be ratified. So this has already gone through the political process and been adopted by the democratic process. And so, it cannot be that obeying the plain text of the constitutional provision here, which is democratically enacted, is somehow anti-democratic. But that was my ability to try to summarize the concerns and say why I don't think people should be, pay those too much heed.
Exactly. I agree. I found it interesting. You also mentioned that the framers of the clause did create a way to remove a disqualification through the political process. So if someone is disqualified from serving in public office, Congress may, by a two-thirds margin in each chamber, reverse that decision. And I believe that happened in the late 1800s, correct? There was an incident where it was reversed?
You're exactly right. There's a very clear provision that allows Congress to remove the disqualification, and that actually happened twice in the late 1800s. There were two Confederate Amnesty Acts that were considered and then passed by Congress by that supermajority, which shamefully, in my opinion, removed the disqualification. But, you know, regardless of your feelings about that, it just shows that there is a clear congressional path if Congress wants to remove this disqualification. So I think that the framers of this amendment were very careful to allow a variety of different actors, including Congress, to be part of a conversation about constitutional accountability to this provision.
Now, the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics, also based in Washington, D.C., was successful last year in using Section 3 to successfully block a New Mexico County commissioner who also participated in the January 6th insurrection from holding public office. I find that hopeful. Does it give you hope that more states may bring disqualification suits, especially now in light of Colorado's ruling?
I mean, I think that's right. And I should say that Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington also, you know, were the lawyers who are representing the voters in Colorado, along with local counsel. And so the New Mexico County Commissioner Coy Griffin, who was removed through 14.3 action that you're referencing, you know, that was groundbreaking when it happened because it had been one of the first adjudications in, you know, over 100 years. And I think it's hopeful to me that not only would more suits be brought for officers who violated their oaths and engaged in insurrection, but I also hope it will be a warning shot for future potential insurrectionists saying, okay, I've got to take this oath seriously, because if I plan to hold office again in the future, or even if I plan to hold office right now, you know, this oath I took has to be one that I take seriously. So I think it's hopeful not only for other disqualification suits, but it's also hopeful as a constitutional signal that this provision in the Constitution is not a mere ornament, it's not a dead letter, it's a real constitutional provision, and it has force of law.
Praveen, we now come to the million-dollar question. With the Colorado ruling, this case is likely going to end up before the Supreme Court. And I wanted to note that in a 2012 decision in a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals case, then-Judge Neil Gorsuch ruled that a state's legitimate interest in protecting the integrity and practical functioning of the political process precludes it, and I'm quoting here from the now justice, to exclude from the ballot candidates who are constitutionally prohibited from assuming office. Does that give you any hope that the Supreme Court might do the right thing if this case reaches them? And we should note that by the time this show airs, there's a possibility it might go before the high court.
It does give me hope that the Supreme Court will do the right thing. You're citing this Hassan decision from the Tenth Circuit of Court of Appeals that then Judge Gorsuch wrote, who's now Justice Gorsuch. And so we know there's at least one person who has a record of saying that, you know, yes, states have this interest in protecting the integrity of their political process. And of course, they're allowed to exclude from the ballot candidates who are constitutionally ineligible from assuming office. And of course, that one was about someone who wanted to run for presidential office who was not born in the United States. And so, you know, it's another presidential constitutional requirement that's in the plain text. I think the other thing that gives me hope is that the text and history of this constitutional provision is so clear. And there have been a number of justices who at least have professed to be governed by text and history. There are a number of individuals who said that they're originalists and said they care about the enactment history of a provision as they are trying to figure out what a provision means. And, you know, if you're faithful to that methodology, the result here should be clear. And, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about that.
We just have a few minutes remaining, Praveen, and I know this is an extremely busy few days for you in light of the Colorado decision, so I'd like to thank you for joining us. As we mentioned earlier, the Constitutional Accountability Center has filed, what I see, more than 300 amicus briefs, and 100 of those have been before the Supreme Court. If there's time, do you anticipate filing one in this case?
You know, actually, I just checked with, because I was just thinking about the numbers, I just checked with CAC's chief counsel, Brianne Gorod, who heads up our litigation shop. And I actually think we're now a little north of 400 amicus briefs and 200 at the Supreme Court. So those numbers are outdated. Yes, I do anticipate, you know, obviously we're watching things, and things are moving very quickly at the Supreme Court. It might be by the time your listeners hear this that the Supreme Court has granted cert. Who knows? But we're watching it, and we certainly anticipate. We've been involved at the lower levels with amicus briefs, and we certainly anticipate the potential of being involved if the Supreme Court takes this up.
And Praveen, how can our listeners follow your work and that of the Constitutional Accountability Center?
Oh, you're kind to ask. Well, our website would be the place to start. Our website is theusconstitution.org. We have litigation tabs about all of our cases that describes our cases and links you to the documents, our briefs, et cetera, as well as descriptions of the cases that hopefully will be digestible to a large chunk of your audience. So I would welcome anyone checking out the website.
Well, you got a great domain name there, I must say.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. It's great to be part of, you know, the mantle of the Constitution, which of course belongs to all of us in this nation.
Yes, well said. Praveen, again, it's been a really busy and eventful week. Thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, and thank you for your work.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Heidi, and thanks for your interest in this case and our work.